Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk about the United Nations Security Council sanctions against Iran. We'll be speaking with Graham Fuller, who's a former vice chair of the National Intelligence Council at the Central Intelligence Agency. He's lived for more than 20 years in the Middle East as the author of a number of books on the region, including The Center of the Universe, The Geopolitics of Iran, The Democracy Trap, Perils of the Post-Cold War World, A Sense of Siege, The Geopolitics of Islam and the West, The Arab Shia, The Forgotten Muslims, and most recently, The Future of Political Islam. On this program, Background Briefing, in early 2003, Graham Fuller warned before the war began that President Bush's utopian remaking of Iraq as a democratic state was remote, unrealistic, and would be very disruptive throughout the Middle East. So we'll be talking about where things stand with Iran in the context of a number of British Marines were captured by the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, and that possibly could be a trigger for a broader crisis. We'll also speak with Dawn Johnson, who served in the Clinton administration as the Deputy Assistant Attorney General and then the Acting Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Counsel, where she advised the Attorney General, the White House Counsel, and the General Counsels of all the executive departments and agencies. She will be talking to us, of course, about the fate of Attorney General Gonzalez and the extent to which the document dump from the Justice Department to the Congress has a number of doctored documents as well as an 18-day gap in the document flow. And we'll be talking to her about this possible constitutional crisis, as it's been referred to, but of course in the context of the Clinton administration, where there are over 1,000 subpoenas and 36 executive branch officials testify before Congress, there does seem to be a problem with the scale here. And then we'll speak with Mayor Rocky Anderson, who's won national attention as a liberal progressive mayor of Salt Lake City in the red state of Utah, which is, by some accounts, the most conservative state in the United States, and in a state which supports President Bush more than any other state, perhaps. Mayor Anderson, now in his second term, has cited the president as a war criminal, and recently at an anti-war rally in Washington, D.C., called for President Bush's impeachment. I'm now speaking with Graham Fuller, who was the former vice chair of the National Intelligence Council at the Central Intelligence Agency. He's written a number of books on the Middle East, having spent over 20 years traveling and working in the Middle East. His most recent, The Future of Political Islam. He also speaks Arabic and appears on Al Jazeera as a private citizen. I guess lately, Graham, if you've been on Al Jazeera, it's an uphill battle since you speak as a private American citizen, to put America in a good light. On this program before the Iraq War, you warned about the utopian notion of making a democratic state out of Iraq, that it was remote, unrealistic, and would be very disruptive throughout the Middle East. It seems in retrospect that your diagnosis was somewhat mild.
Well, yes. I mean, I don't think it was that it was strictly utopian that Iraq could ever become a democracy. I don't think anything like that is written in stone. But I think that delivering democracy by sword point and through incredible application of violence is not, that is the thing that is not realistic. And unfortunately, under the wisest of policies, and the most intelligent approach, it would have been a tough prospect to fulfill. But obviously, we know that it hasn't been wisely and intelligently pursued. So it's all the harder to get out from this.
But it seems the most obvious thing that has resulted from our invasion and occupation of Iraq has been the fact that we've empowered and emboldened Iran. First of all, we removed Iran's two enemies, the Taliban on their eastern side and Saddam Hussein on their western side. And now that the United Nations Security Council has just invoked sanctions against Iran, we do seem to be, there's been talk for some time that there may be a military action against Iran, which has never seemed like a rational proposition. But the military assets are in place, so even if it's we're exacting some leverage out of the threat, there's still the possibility of a small event triggering a wider conflagration, and that is pretty much what's happening now with the British Marines and sailors who were captured by the Revolutionary Guards. What's your feeling in terms of this thing being a possible tripwire?
Well, obviously, when you bring that much force to bear and bringing three fleets into the Gulf area, you've raised the prospects of a breakout of conflict very considerably. On the other hand, I think at this point the chances of the United States launching a military attack against Iran are considerably less than they would have been 6 months or a year ago. And this is primarily due to simply America's own weakening position with the given the disaster in Iraq, we can barely even muster enough troops to go on there, and rising opposition within the United States to further such adventures, and huge international concern about such a step. It's really very tough now for the administration to open yet another war front. But that said, as you mentioned. And perhaps much of the purpose of this military show, U.S. military show, is to intimidate the Iranians into agreement. Unfortunately, the track record of any country intimidating Iran successfully into certain course of action is not great. So I do very much worry that even if war is not intended, that it could break out here spontaneously. And finally, I'd have to add, Iran has been its own worst enemy, I would say certainly within the last 18 months, in playing its cards quite badly against the U.S. They could have done this much more intelligently if they had wanted to, and I think there is recognition of this within high places within the Iranian government.
But would there be, within the high places in the Iranian government, it's always been pretty opaque to figure out who really runs that place. Isn't there essentially we talked in your day when you were on the National Security Council, with the crisis in Iran, during the Iran-Iraq war, there was talk of Iranian moderates, and some of the stuff that you wrote was sort of used by Oliver North and others as an excuse for the Iran-Contra deal. But the long and the short of it is that this idea that they're pragmatists and religious ideologues, perhaps does that explain why they've been playing their cards badly, that you have a religious ideologue? I understand that Ahmadinejad, even though his powers may be limited, he is a religious fanatic, if you will. He's a Twelfther. He believes in the hidden imam, this apocalyptic idea that the imam is going to return. He sends notes down the wells in Qom. That when they blew up the mosque in Samarra, where the imam was last seen, I guess, is buried. Is he buried there? I'm not sure, but the long and the short of it is he that was supposedly an apocalyptic moment for him. So give us a sense of whether the country is, you know, has this problem of pragmatists versus religious ideologues.
Right. Well, look, this is a very large country with a very complex form of government. This is nothing remotely resembling something like, say, the Soviet Union in earlier days, or even Saddam Hussein, where one man dominates and controls everything in some rule of fear. This is a pretty wide open country in lots of respects. I mean, people who go there, you can talk to Iranians about almost any subject, and people aren't constantly looking over their shoulder. There's a lot of frankness. The press is often a free for all. Newspapers are shut down by the government, and they open with a new name a week later. There's a lot going on there. I don't want to suggest this is some kind of beautiful democracy, but it would also be a mistake to think that this is some sort of closed totalitarian system. So we've got a lot of different groups competing with each other here. In one sense, Ahmadinejad is certainly a very religious man. I think he's also in many ways a very cunning politician. and plays on these religious views as a populist. Ironically, also, he's very much a threat to the clerical regime because he's not a cleric himself. He doesn't like clerics running things, even if he is religious. But I think his biggest mistake is, apart from upsetting a lot of the religious leadership of the country, has been his inept, I would say inept, I think many, many top Iranians also would view inept handling of the West. Looking, and if I were an Iranian leader, I think what I would want to do would be to split off the United States from the rest of the Western world. And actually, Iran under Khatami in an earlier period was somewhat successful in doing this. He had a very nice way with the West, a good diplomat, and the policies were much more rational. And he was able to place wedges between United States neocon radical views and those of the Europeans and Russians and Chinese. Today, that's not the case. His outspoken, often fanatic rhetoric, usually designed to please the crowds more than necessarily anything that's deeply believed, has definitely weakened Iran's ability to play the diplomatic game, and we now see every country in the world at this UN vote, or I should say certainly every country on the Security Council, ultimately supporting the new sanctions against Iran. I don't know that these sanctions will be universally applied in the same way, but it's a sign that much of the world is very tired of Iran's manipulations in this way, and I think it's clear the regime is already making efforts to try to back off from some of this more confrontational stuff.
But Graham Foley, you could also make the same argument in reverse, if you will, that the United States has been totally unsuccessful and counterproductive and counterintuitive in trying to drive a wedge between the state and the society, and that prior to our intervention in Iraq, it did seem that the religious authorities were on the ropes, and that there was a great deal of activism on the part of the young and the women who make up the majority of Iran, and that any military action that we take would drive the people back into the hands of the mullahs and condemn them to another two decades of misrule.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. The more the U.S. Threat, the threat of U.S. belligerency and the presence of these huge fleets in the region rise, the more it tends to bring unity among the population, even if they don't like their government in many respects. But let's not forget, Ahmadinejad was elected. This was a genuine election that Iran had in those days. It was not a fully fair election in that all kinds of other candidates were disqualified, but there were a lot of candidates to choose among who had differing views, and people watched the election very closely. And Ahmadinejad was sort of a dark horse who came out of the woodwork with a great deal of popular support. So I think that's an encouragement that if this guy is failing, if he's clearly dropping the ball, as he is in so many respects, he's not going to survive much longer. And as I said earlier, I think already steps are underway to try to remove some of his control over key policy areas. That's already happening. Now, in this latest seizure of British naval officials in the Gulf, it would seem, we don't have an accurate reading, but it would seem that that the British boats were in fact in Iraqi and not in Iranian waters, as the Iranians claim. But it's certainly part of Iran's traditional game strategy that when it looks like there might be the moderates might be willing to make a deal with the West, then the radicals weigh in and create some incident that then blows it all up, and no such agreement is possible. I don't know whether that's what's happening in this present incident or not, but it would be typical of past incidents.
Well, it's probably not that difficult to extrapolate, because the sanctions that were just passed by the United Nations Security Council with some resistance from South Africa, Indonesia, and Qatar, they managed to compromise the language, including the idea of a nuclear-free zone, which is a tacit recognition of Israel's role in the region as a covert nuclear power. But the long and the short of it is that these sanctions are targeted against the Revolutionary Guards, 18 individuals, I believe, in banks, and that's one of the opaque things about the financial structure of Iran. The bunyads, these foundations that are run by the mullahs, they basically take about 60% of the budget and 20% of the GDP. And so much of these organizations, like the Revolutionary Guards and the Quds Force, are self-sustaining and autonomous.
That's right, and very much have their own agenda. But here, you know, I think what is really critical for the United States to do now is to simply to bite the bullet and decide that after 25 years of not talking to Iran, that it's about time perhaps to talk to our enemies or to our rivals in the region. I mean, if we could talk to the Chinese, if we could talk to the Soviets, we certainly should be able to talk with the Iranians. I think this in itself would begin to lead to a greater openness within the Iranian system, bring out of the woodwork these various rival groups and open up chances for a greater evolution of the process in Iran. But we have not chosen to do that, and we have largely, through our own refusal to talk, alienated a lot of potential allies in other parts of the world who could work with us. We're just lucky, if you will, that we have a guy like Ahmadinejad who throws his weight around so crudely that even Iran has now lost its potential supporters elsewhere. I don't think this is going to go on, though, for much longer, because, as I say, I think the Iranian leadership and establishment sees that this is simply way too costly. And fortunately, Ahmadinejad does not have his hands on all of the buttons, if you will, of military action in the country. He doesn't control the military or intelligence organizations or a lot of those things. So his power is not unlimited.
And of course, the road ahead for the Iranian position gets worse, because the more they defy the UN Security Council, the stronger the sanctions get. But on the other side, in closing, Graham Fuller, it seems to me that we were talking earlier about the military option, which many people have are concerned about, is not a very realistic option, because it would be so counterintuitive and counterproductive, and probably result in a conflagration in the Gulf, which would inevitably mean a cutoff of the economic lifeline for the industrial world. But the long and the short of it is, it seems to me that the Iranians do, on balance, have many, many more options than we have. And this is why President Bush could be accused of criminal negligence here in terms of geopolitics, because the Iranians have enormous leverage and they could do so much more mischief in Iraq than they're already doing. The shoe hasn't dropped there. And of course, the other shoe hasn't dropped in Afghanistan as well, which probably means that the military option is remote, because we're so stretched thin and preoccupied. But just in closing, give us a sense of the geostrategic panorama there, because it seems as the Sunni seem to be slowly being defeated and ethnically cleansed, they retreat into Jordan, which is an overtaxed million Sunni refugees. Their fighters will be there. They'll be angry. It seems like that the Sunni world is getting destabilized, and I understand Al Jazeera is turning quite strident against the Shia. On the Shiite side, I mean, in effect, it seems like we've empowered the worst on both the Sunni and the Shiite side. But the long and the short of it is, the Iranians seem to have many, many more options, and that's, I guess, where we've committed original sin in geostrategy, where we put the United States in a position where there are no good options.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, we certainly empowered Iran's position in both within Iraq and within Afghanistan within our own policies. But to some extent, this was going to happen anyway. I'd also have to say, Ian, I think Washington has considerably exaggerated and hyped the overall Iranian threat. This is not still a country whose military capabilities are very modest. They couldn't even take on their neighbor Turkey, I think, without suffering serious defeat. So I think we are really trying to see Iran as the sort of source of most of the problems in the Middle East, which is basically not the case. Iran is certainly manipulating the Arab-Israeli problem and the Palestinian problem, but the Palestinian problem would not be significantly changed if Iran were to disappear off the face of the globe tomorrow. It's local and it's inherent, and the Iranians are certainly playing the game. Similarly, much of the so-called Sunni fear of Iran is really fear of the Sunni leaders, pro-American dictators in Mubarak in Egypt and the two King Abdullahs in Jordan and Saudi Arabia. They are afraid of Iran's policies because Iran is appealing over their heads to the masses and saying, look, we in Iran are speaking in the name for Palestinians. We are carrying the flag against the United States. We are the standard bearer against imperialist intervention in the region. We're the ones who are standing up for the right of Islamic nations to be able to have nuclear weapons, et cetera, et cetera. This is what, and it's a populist force that Iran is calling for. They're not speaking in the name of Shiism at all. They're speaking in the name of populism and anti-imperialism and dignity and strength of the Arab world. That terrifies these pro-American dictators who don't dare speak in that language that their own people want them to use. So it's not a simple Sunni-Shiite situation at all, but really one of entrenched Sunni leadership, dictatorial leadership, authoritarian leadership, against a populist voice. Certainly in Iraq, yes. I mean, we're talking about neighborhoods, Sunni and Shiite neighborhoods competing, but over the broader Muslim world, people don't really see it as that much as a Sunni-Shiite confrontation. They see it much more as an anti-imperial issue involving Palestinians and other issues dear to their hearts.
So that would explain the popularity of Nasrallah in the recent war against Lebanon and how
Absolutely.
Much that alarmed the House of Saud and the Hashemites.
Absolutely. I mean, Nasrallah of Hezbollah speaks in he uses Sunni language. I mean, he's fighting for Shiites within Lebanon, but in his international language, this is, you know, he's talking about Palestine, talking about imperialism, talking about all these things. So he and Iran both rank very high in the views of the Arab street. Even though they're Shiites, they have a lot of support, and that's, as I say, what's so scary. Scaring to this very weak set of allies that we have in the region who don't represent public opinion and have very little public support.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
Bye-bye.
Hello
again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Graham Fuller, who's the former vice chair of the National Intelligence Council at the Central Intelligence Agency, the author of a recent book, The Future of Political Islam, and he appears regularly speaking in Arabic on Al Jazeera as a U.S. citizen, trying to overcome the incredible unpopularity of the United States in that region. I'm now speaking with Dawn Johnson, who is on the faculty of Indiana Law School. She's previously, after graduating from Yale Law School, she was a staff counsel at the ACLU, and then during the Clinton administration served as the Deputy Assistant Attorney General and then the Acting Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Counsel, where she advised the Attorney General, the White House Counsel, and the general counsels of all executive departments and agencies. She currently teaches at Indiana Law School courses on constitutional law, First Amendment, and does a seminar on the separation of powers. And, of course, the separation of powers is very much in the news. Dawn Johnson with talk of a constitutional crisis. In the light of what you experienced in the Clinton administration, that does seem to be overstated, the idea that the first time that the Democratic Congress exercises oversight and even talks about subpoenas without issuing them, the president did seem to go ballistic. Contrast that with, 1,000-plus subpoenas that were shot at the Clinton administration, along with, I think, 36 executive branch officials testifying under oath. So how come there isn't this balance here in the coverage in the press?
So just to back up, I do think that the president generally has a very strong interest in making sure that his top officials in the White House are not brought before Congress unnecessarily. But here, where you have evidence of wrongdoing and misstatements and confusion about who knew what when, both regarding the Attorney General and the White House, there definitely is need for a countervailing need for Congress to have more information from the president. And as you mentioned, there are numerous occasions in the past, actually 74 by one count since World War II, when top White House aides have testified before congressional committees. And most of those times were during the Clinton administration. So it's all a matter of whether the need for the information by Congress outweighs the need for confidentiality in the White House. And here we do clearly have a need for much more information.
Well, the president is saying that the Congress is on a fishing expedition, and his surrogates are saying on television that there's no underlying criminal complaint here. And, of course, conversely, or in contrast, most of the attacks on Clinton and subpoenas were related to Whitewater, which I think, in retrospect, was a fishing expedition. There was very little there, or no there. But I think it seems to, isn't it clear that from Senator Lay and others on the Judiciary Committee, that what's bothering them, and it's worth noting that three prominent Republicans, Specter, Hagel, and Lindsey Graham, along with Senator Feinstein, have called for the Attorney General's resignation. They're not happy with the answers that have been given so far. And Leahy's extremely distressed about the document dump that came from the Justice Department, where there's an awful lot of what Leahy says is whiting out of documents. In other words, blank pages clearly have been whited out. An 18-day gap between November the 15th and December the 7th, the day that the decisions to fire these U.S. attorneys was made?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what you described absolutely is appropriately upsetting members of Congress, and I think it's useful to think about in the larger context of years of Congress being unhappy with the lack of information the executive branch is willing to provide. You know, I think we clearly have an administration now that operates with hyper-secrecy. That's one concern. Another is inadequate respect for the rule of law. You know, I think this has to be considered in the context generally of concern members of Congress have about what the tone at the Department of Justice is. You know, how are they doing their job? Are they allowing politics to influence that in inappropriate ways? And that's exactly one of the specific issues here. We don't have all the facts yet. We don't know yet if there has been criminal wrongdoing or even a wrongful firing, but we do have significant evidence already that perhaps at least David Iglesias from New Mexico was the subject of improper influence in regard to federal prosecutions, allowing politics, you know, the political party affiliation of the target influence whether a prosecution would go forward. You know, if it turns out that actually did happen, that a U.S. attorney was pressured to go after somebody at a particular time before an election because they were a Democrat, that clearly is the proper subject of congressional oversight and completely illegitimate for the Attorney General and the White House and members of Congress to have any part of, and completely undermines, I think, the confidence that Americans have in our system of law. So what's at issue here is incredibly important and definitely does justify at least some additional information coming out of the White House at this point. And what the president so far has offered through his counsel, Fred Fielding, clearly is inadequate to the demonstrated congressional need and public need for more information at this point.
You mean private meetings with White House officials, not sworn in, not under oath, and no transcripts, and no ability to call them back?
That's exactly right, yes. And that last part is, I think, particularly outrageous, I would say. You know, to say that you may take this first step in an investigation, unsworn, private, no transcript, and not come back, regardless of what you might learn in those interviews. This is a one bite at the apple kind of thing, and agree up front, no subsequent testimony or issuance of subpoenas just is completely inconsistent with how anyone would conduct, you know, any kind of investigation.
But Senator Feinstein, who just Sunday called for Gonzalez to resign, she seems to be convinced that Carol Lam, the U.S. attorney down in San Diego, was improperly fired because she was looking into Kyle Dusty Fargo and his relationship to Brett Wilkes, this crooked contractor who really was a war profiteer, based upon the reporting of the Copley newspapers. It's pretty obscene, his attitude to the Iraq war was, wow, this is a great profit opportunity. And also the connections in the FBI looking into Congressman Jerry Lewis out here in San Bernardino, who was head of the Appropriations Committee, a very senior Republican. So Feinstein's suggestion is that there was a political motive, and then the McClatchy papers are reporting, and they've done some very good work on this, they're reporting that the real motive in firing everybody was that they wanted to, that Rove wanted to put people in there who would zealously pursue so-called voter fraud. And as you know, one man's voter fraud is another man's emancipation.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. I would say that there is clearly enough, you've outlined much of it, and in addition, the situation I described with former U.S. Attorney David Iglesias, there's definitely enough out there that we need to know more. We do not know for certain that there was illegal activity, you know, so we don't want to exaggerate that. But we clearly know that what's at issue here is not a fishing expedition. If it were, I would be firmly on the side of the president here. You know, if Congress has no evidence, then the testimony of close White House officials would be inappropriate. We do need to need to protect the right of the president to have candid, blunt, unpopular advice from the highest officials in the vast majority of cases. But when you get the kind of evidence that is out there now of potential wrongdoing and also misstatements, misleading testimony from the Attorney General of the United States about what his involvement was and what the White House involvement was, then we absolutely need to ask more questions and get more information.
And in terms of just proportionality, going back to the Clinton days, it seemed to me that in many ways what that whole experience was about politics by other means. In other words, the law being used as a political weapon. And that there was, given that so much of the Whitewater scandal was funded by a kind of bilious billionaire, Richard Mellon Scaife, and that they went and they literally found Paula Jones and they were hounding, it seemed to me that a lot of that was exactly what the president is now decrying, a fishing expedition conducted by Ken Starr looking for something. And I think, 15 special prosecutions were conducted, thousands of subpoenas, and I think 36 officials testified. And we know the whole history of it, but do you share the belief that that was politics by other means? In other words, there's been a tradition in American politics, one side wins, the other side licks their wounds, comes back 4 years later, and that there was a constituency in the Republican Party that didn't accept Clinton's victory, if you will, blamed Perot and decided, we'll do anything to get rid of this guy.
Right. Well, I definitely, my own personal view is that there definitely was some of that going on, some inappropriate use of weapons that for political purposes against the Clinton administration. I do think, though, that that is kind of a cautionary tale and shows that we need to look at every situation closely on its facts and make sure we don't have that again. You know, because the Republicans did that to the Democrats does not license the Democrats to do it to the Republicans. And if this truly was that kind of a politically motivated fishing expedition, I would say that the Democrats have no right to do that either. But as we just discussed, there's much evidence already that there might have been wrongdoing here and that we are not getting the straight story. So that's not an issue. And I'll also add, this is not a partisan thing. You know, there are Republicans in Congress who are also unhappy with the information that they've received so far, the conflicting information and the evidence of possible wrongdoing, and are calling upon the White House to be more forthcoming. So we're not talking about, in this case, the same kind of partisan attempt to force White House officials to provide more information.
But I think a lot of the Republicans who are angry, some of them are from the Western states where the U.S. attorneys were dismissed for, apparently many of them got high ratings and yet were dismissed. And if you would, since you've worked both in the Attorney General's office and in liaison with White House Special Counsel, the understanding is that all the U.S. attorneys serve as the president has been reminding us, at the pleasure of the president, and they keep citing the fact that Clinton got rid of all 93, which I think is how they clean house, at any rate, mm-hmm. as a new administration comes in. It doesn't seem to hold true in terms of the administration's argument, because they already had put their people in, and then they got reelected, so it wasn't the same thing as cleaning house with a new administration.
Mm-hmm.
How does it work, though, in terms of if the McClatchy reports that have proven to be pretty accurate so far indicate that Rove's motive was to put people in there who would help them in 2008 with suppressing Democratic votes, the White House give the U.S. attorneys their marching orders? Once they appoint them, they can't meddle with them, but they choose them for political reasons. Now, I understood that the marching orders that Gonzalez and company had given them was to go after affirmative action wherever they could find it, and pornography.
Mm-hmm. And I think that it's totally appropriate for the president to, through the Attorney General or otherwise, to direct the U.S. attorneys about priorities and what kinds of cases should be made a priority. I think it also would be within the president's authority in the beginning of his second term or in the last year of his second term to fire U.S. attorneys and replace them because he believes they are not pursuing the administration's policy objectives. If it's done in a nonpartisan way, you know, the way you described it was suppress Democratic votes, that's clearly an impermissible reason to fire a U.S. attorney because they're not acting to suppress Democratic votes and administering the law in a partisan fashion. That would be clearly inappropriate and illegitimate. But the president has very broad discretion to replace U.S. attorneys as long as it's not done in illegitimate fashion.
But, Don Johnson, the loophole which Rove and Gonzalez and his assistant, Sampson, appeared to drive a truck through was a loophole that was put in the law in case a terrorist attack killed a bunch of U.S. attorneys, for example, the Oklahoma bombing, and that therefore they could replace them without having to get confirmation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Senate has closed that loophole, 98-2.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
So that gives you
another good cautionary tale about Congress being overly deferential to presidential demands in the context of the so-called war on terror. And not looking closely enough and considering the implications of legislation. And then the president, I think, in many instances, not acting in goodwill, not exercising discretion given to the president by Congress to use in exceptional circumstances in a way that is fair and balanced and really respectful of the rule of law. And that, you know, the concern about the FBI misusing national security letters, it's just been so much in the news, that the direction from the Department of Justice to the president that he can disregard federal criminal statutes that prohibit torture. You know, we have a whole history, I think, of the president and the Department of Justice not enforcing the laws in the way they're written. And so valid concern here about whether the firing of the U.S. attorneys was done in a non-political fashion. And that's what we just need to know. We need more information.
Well, just in terms of the doctoring documents, which is the accusation that Senator Leahy's making, he held up a bunch of documents that clearly didn't make sense. There was huge portions of them whited out. I recall back in the days when, in the Clinton days, you know, they had a hard time even finding an attorney general. The first one, Zoe Baird, got into trouble because of Nannygate, and then Kimber Wood apparently had done a Playboy spread, and then Webb Hubble had all kinds of troubles. And then I recall that Dan Burton, who was the Republican chair, they even doctored transcripts of Webb Hubble's interviews, you know, making it sound like he was in league with this crooked banker Riady. So it's not as if this hasn't happened before. So I thought that if the documents that were sent over, bearing in mind this 18-day gap in the critical period before the decisions were made, if they can prove that these documents have been doctored, isn't that a serious breach of, breach of trust between the branches of government?
It could be. When you talk about doctoring documents, if the White House has a legitimate basis for deleting certain information...
Yeah, but they usually black them out. They don't white them out.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. You clearly indicate to Congress, what you should do is clearly indicate to Congress what you are withholding and why, rather than making it seem as if there is nothing there. All this definitely needs to be further investigated. As I said earlier, I really am a strong believer in the need to protect confidentiality of certain kinds of information in the White House. The government cannot function without a high degree of candid, confidential advice. And if White House officials are hauled before Congress in fishing expeditions, I mean, that would just cause the government to grind to a halt. And we've seen examples in the past where that was done excessively. So we do need to be cautious. But here there's clearly, as I said, adequate evidence out there already that there were possibly illegitimate considerations and that we're not hearing the complete true story so far. White House has to be compelled
right.
to force...
Well, just in closing, it seems that, at the risk of reading too much into Leahy and others' attitude, is that they don't feel they've gotten the straight story so far,
right.
And that they appear to be very suspicious of the documents they've gotten. And furthermore, mm-hmm. it does appear that the president went sort of ballistic. I mean, he's on the beginning of the fifth year of the Iraq War, he made a very kind of, boilerplate, tired kind of speech. But this time he was really animated, unusually so. So you get the feeling that they're worried about something here. Perhaps I'm reading too much into it.
I think what you said is right, that Leahy and other senators, I think in both parties, have really gone to an extreme in the past to give the president and the rest of the administration the benefit of the doubt. But when they feel they have been misled in this and other contexts, and that just generally, as I said, you have an administration that is operating in a state of hyper secrecy, and we don't have the kind of transparent government that we need, that Congress needs, the press needs, to even monitor whether the law is being complied with. That, I think, has a cumulative effect on the willingness of Congress to give them the benefit of the doubt. And so here I think we're just reaching a tipping point where you don't have the basic underlying trust because the White House has really, not earned it.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Dawn Johnson.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking there with Dawn Johnson, who served in the Clinton administration as a Deputy Assistant Attorney General and then the Acting Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Counsel, where she advised the Attorney General, the White House Counsel, and the General Counsels of all executive departments and agencies. I'm now speaking with Mayor Rocky Anderson, who's won national acclaim as a liberal progressive mayor of Salt Lake City in the red state of Utah, which by some accounts is one of the most conservative states in the United States, the state which supports President Bush perhaps more than others. And now Mayor Anderson is in his second term. And recently, Mayor Anderson, you were at an anti-war rally in Washington, D.C., where you mentioned that President Bush was perhaps a war criminal, and rather emphatically, you called for his impeachment.
I did, and I'm proud to do that. I used to think that calls for impeachment were a little extreme, but the more you look into it, the more you become absolutely convinced that what this president has done has been so injurious. He has violated numerous of our most solemn treaty obligations, including the UN Charter, and engaging in this war of aggression from the very outset. And that's a huge deal. I think people give such short shrift to that. But following World War II, nations of the world came together. We led them, and we agreed it would be internationally outlawed for any nation to attack another nation unless it was in self-defense. And there was nothing close to there being an attack or an imminent attack by Iraq against the United States. Therefore, it was a clearly illegal act to invade and occupy that country, a massive violation of international law. And by the way, these treaties under Article 6 of the United States Constitution are, along with the Constitution, the supreme law of the land. And then, of course, in the execution of this war, ordering the kidnapping and sending people off to other nations where they're going to be tortured, clearly illegal, both under international law and under our own domestic law. In fact, this kind of situation was treated specifically in the Foreign Affairs Reform and Restructuring Act of 1998. Clearly prohibited this sort of thing. But this president has made it clear that because this is a time that he calls a war on terror, that anything goes for the president. He has asserted a shocking, this is such a frightening concept, a unitary executive power. He uses that language. In fact, he uses it in his signing statements when he signs legislation, that he basically is saying that he'll decide whether that legislation can be applied to him and under what circumstances, since he's the all-powerful president. President that's above the Constitution.
Well, he uses the rubric that we're at war and he's a wartime president and he's the commander-in-chief. And, of course, it doesn't make a lot of sense to be the commander-in-chief of the American people. It certainly makes sense to be the commander-in-chief of the American armed forces.
Yeah, never has this country adopted, even in times of war, the concept that we throw away the concept of balance of power between the judiciary, the Congress, and the president. That's why we have the balance of power written into our Constitution, so that a president under any set of circumstances is not going to be able to assume dictatorial powers. But this president has made our country seem more and more like those nations from whom we've always been so proud to distinguish ourselves.
Well, tell me, though, how you could proceed with an impeachment given the Constitution, which states, I think, pretty clearly that the president can be removed for bribery or treason or high crimes and misdemeanors. Now, obviously, bribery, maybe there's been some. But
high crimes and misdemeanors has reference. You know, Bill O'Reilly was asking me about this. He says, now, you've got to prove a crime. Well, Bill O'Reilly has no understanding whatsoever of what the impeachment clause of the Constitution means or what the tradition of impeachment in Britain was. High crimes and misdemeanors makes reference to political crimes. It means that a president has abused his power, breached the trust with either Congress or the American people, even his misleading the Congress or the American people into war would be a high crime or misdemeanor. The violation of our Constitution, of our solemn treaty obligations, of domestic law, all of those things constitute the kind of egregious abuse of power, breach of trust, that would constitute an impeachable offense. And by the way, impeachment was meant to deal with those kinds of abuses of executive power that do great injury to our nation. And so when the Republicans, for the most highly partisan reasons, sought to and did impeach President Clinton. Impeachment, by the way, is simply like an indictment from the House of Representatives sending it over to the Senate to actually try the president. President Clinton was one of two presidents in this country ever to actually be impeached, and it was for lying under oath in a private lawsuit about a private sexual matter. Absolutely outrageous that there would ever be considered impeachment.
It was a civil matter that was treated as a criminal matter. But what you're saying, Mayor Rocky Anderson, is that there is a political definition for impeachment beyond the narrow legal one.
The impeachment clause of the Constitution was never intended to be applied only to criminal offenses, violations of the criminal code. It's written there to prevent against the very kind of thing we're experiencing in this country. The founders were afraid of somebody coming in and asserting tyrannical powers, abusing the executive power. They just gone through the experience with the king.
Sure.
And they want to make sure, in fact, there were fears that George Washington, being as popular as he was going to step into the presidency and assert that kind of monarchical power, tyrannical power.
Let me ask you, though.
The clause was meant to protect our democracy, to protect our balance of power in this country, the kinds of things that are very much at risk under this president.
And you're one of the rare people that have actually stood up and used this word, and it's obviously a word that Nancy Pelosi is afraid to use, and there are political consequences, at least that she sees it, that you get into a kind of recriminations. And we talked earlier about...
I think it's ironic and very sad that the breaches of power by this president, many of them have been permitted and even promoted by this highly irresponsible Congress, I think a really cowardly Congress. And so I think Nancy Pelosi saying that impeachment is off the table is more of a defensive move. I think that they're worried about, you know, if they claim that the president has asserted too much executive power, that he's misused his power, the finger's going to be pointed back at them, and people are going to be wondering, why didn't you stand up and meet your constitutional obligations rather than giving this president a blank check to engage in this illegal war of aggression?
But Mayor Rocky Anderson, I think a lot of people are curious about you, your personal political talent, if you will. Here you are in a highly red state, a popular Democrat, liberal, progressive. You're talking about the fact that the Democrats appear to be afraid of their own shadow. That during the Cold War, they were terrified of being seen as soft on communism. Now they appear to be terrified of being soft on terrorism, and that they have basically enabled this president through their cowardice. I agree with you entirely. You talk about a culture and obedience in much of this country that's worse in Utah than anywhere else. Now that reminds me of some of the work of George Lakoff, the idea that there's an authoritarian kind of streak in the Republican cadre, if you will. Explain that a little further, if you will.
Well, there is an enormous culture of obedience, a very frightening culture of obedience in this country, where people will stand behind those who they perceive being the people in authority without regard to their underlying values. I don't think the American people, if you ask them, would say, yes, I believe in a president assuming a unitary power, that is the power beyond the reach of the Constitution, Congress, and our courts. I don't think most people would say that they believe that a president should be able to order or even condone the kidnapping, the disappearance, the holding of people without charges being brought against them, and sending them off to be tortured, or turning a blind eye to the torture of hundreds of people who have been held in confinement, and even some people having been killed during the course of torture, with almost no accountability and certainly no supervisory accountability from any superior officers. throughout this horrendous episode in our country.
Well, it would be a different matter if our president had been successful in his misadventures. Had he won a war, he's lost one war, he's in the process of losing another. And if he takes on a third, he'll lose that big time, to quote the vice president. So it seems to me that given the disastrous record of George W. Bush, it's extraordinary that there's any obedience left.
Isn't it? And really, if you ask people, should the President of the United States be able to violate the Bill of Rights, any of the Bill of Rights that are there to prevent we, the American people, against abuses by our government? I think most people would say absolutely not. And if you ask them, if a president secretly engaged for over 2 years in a program of our government listening in on the conversations of American citizens, like the Soviets during the times of the Gulag, like so many other dictatorships and tyrannies, I think most people would say absolutely not. We would never stand for that to happen. And if a president did that, they should be impeached. Well, that's exactly what's been going on. And it seems like all it gets is a big yawn from the people in this country and the most astounding complacency and sort of an equating of people of their obedience to the president with patriotism, when patriotism really is about love of country, not the idolization of one person and his administration that's done so much damage to this country.
Well, Mayor Rocky Anderson, I'm afraid we've run out of time. I wanted to talk to you about your post-political life. you're going to be a recovering politician soon.
Well, yeah.
And I know you want to get yourself involved in global warming and other issues. But can we revisit you then?
I'd love to join you again. Thanks a lot for taking the time.
Pleasure. Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm speaking then with Mayor Rocky Anderson, who's won national attention as the Liberal Progressive Mayor of Salt Lake City in the Red State of Utah, and we're talking to him about his recent call at a demonstration in Washington, D.C. against the war to impeach President George W. Bush. I thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, the associate producer, Rusty Nguyen, the assistant producer, Elliot Fong, and Melissa Figueroa, the engineer. This program is available at kpfk.org for podcasting, and if you want further archives, they're available at ianmasters.org, and you can get in touch with me as well at ianmasters.org.